morning. I'm Al Haskell. I'm your this morning's board rep and from the board. And there are a variety of announcements in your order of service. Please read them. Take this order with you if you'd like. Could you greet one another, and while doing so, come forward. It's kind of a small group today. Let's get a little closer together, if you would, please.
Nobody in front of you, so. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks, I know that was hard. If you're visiting with us today, I'd like to particularly welcome you, and please come again. Hope you enjoy your visit today. There is a guest ledger in the foyer, and so please take a moment to sign that and pick up any literature in the front that you would find of interest. There's quite a variety of stuff out there. I'll be in the social hall after the service, and if you've got questions about our church, about Unitarian Universalism, please come find me. That'd be great. No visitors with children, so we'll skip that. There are some. Well, they're hiding. sorry. Today's RE program, our religious education program, is an intergenerational program. The kids will be going outside and learning how to survive, learning how the outer world survives in the winter. You can pick them up in a couple of weeks. It'll be fine. Okay. And if there is anybody visiting us today that would be comfortable in saying hello, we always enjoy getting to know our guests. So if you are in such a situation, please stand up, wave your hand, say hello. we'll talk later. Apparently I'm off script. All right. Now, everyone's welcome to join in our social hall after the service. A key part of you use is coffee, so you'll find that out there and hopefully a pleasant conversation. It's at this point that you should have your phones quieted, phasers on stun, locked, and such. This morning's service is brought to you by our inimitable, am I saying that right? Mr. Paul Fackler. So I hope you'll find today's service interesting, thought-provoking, and thanks for coming.
Opening words today are by Susan B. Anthony. Cautious, careful people, always casting about to preserve their reputation and social standing, never can bring about reform. Those who are really in earnest must be willing to be anything or nothing in the world's estimation, and publicly and privately, in season and out, avow their sympathy with despised and persecuted ideas and their advocates, and bear the consequences. We light our chalice today to represent the flame that burns within each of us, to speak out, to challenge, to advocate for justice and change that will make the world a better place. Please join in our opening hymn, number 361. Please rise as you're willing and able.
Please join me in the congregational ingathering, number 565. I'll read the bold, if you'll read the italics. Always, it is easier to pay homage to prophets than to heed the direction of their vision.
It is easier to align to venerate the saints than to learn the human quality of their sainthood.
It is easier to glorify the heroes of the race than
to give weight to their examples.
To worship the wise is much easier than to profit by their wisdom.
Great leaders are honored not by adulation, but by sharing their insights and values.
Grandchildren of those who stone the prophets sometimes gather up the stones to build the prophet's monument.
Always it is easier to pay homage to prophets than to heed the direction of their visions.
I invite the children to come forward and those young at heart to join in the story for all ages.
And you're all going to stay far back because I'm a dangerous man. So, did you all have good holidays? I had to show off one of my gifts. I got these at Christmas, and they're kind of cool. So, they're magnets, and I think magnets are the world's way of saying that we have to deal with a lot of different people, and we'll end up being stuck together with them for a long time. So, how many of you have an imaginary friend or know somebody with an imaginary friend? You have an imaginary friend? Judy, okay. You have an imaginary friend as well? Or? Are they the same imaginary friend, perchance, or related? Just two Judys. Interesting. Very interesting. So, what does your... I mean, there's a very famous movie called Harvey, in which there's a 6 foot, 3.5 inch tall invisible rabbit. That's the imaginary friend of Jimmy Stewart's character in the movie. And so, you know, I think that may have, you'd think more adults have imaginary friends, but apparently a lot of us stop having imaginary friends at some point. But what do you do with your imaginary friends? What can you tell me about them? So they're both named Judy.
Judy and I hang out a lot.
Okay, so Judy... Judy is protective of you in a certain way, so keeps your brothers honest and professional. So I thought of a good name. I was thinking of inventing an imaginary friend, and so the name for mine, I didn't think of Judy, although, you know, that seems to be a popular name. I thought Milford Q. Happenstance, Ph.D. I like the Ph.D. on the end for some reason. What skills does, I mean, your Judy will protect you, so what sort of skills would an imaginary friend have? If you were inventing one for yourself, say, you know, I really need an imaginary friend. What kind of skills would you give your imaginary friend? What would you have them do, be able to do? Teleporting would be good. You're late for school. Hey, I'm just going to teleport with my imaginary friend. Is your imaginary friend visible or invisible? Can you see her? Okay, so she's visible to you, invisible to everybody else. It's very interesting. A imaginary friend, some people feel that they're entirely invisible. They're invisible even to them. Other people have imaginary friends that are you know visible to them, but not to other people. Did you bring Judy with you this morning? Oh, she didn't want to come forward? Okay. She's not that fearless. Okay. So, next question. Do we act differently for different people? Do you ever find yourself behaving differently when certain people are in the room? So, you know, you're hanging out with your friends, you're having a good time, you're talking, your mom or dad come into the room. Do you suddenly find yourself behaving differently? And so it's something we commonly do. So do you behave differently with your imaginary friend?
No.
No. So lets you be yourself more than anybody else?
Yeah.
Okay. So why do you think people have imaginary friends? Why do you have imaginary friends?
Because Judy's awesome.
Awesomeness.
She's not a magician.
Well, I read a little bit about this, and it seems that people have imaginary friends for a number of different reasons, and the four that I read about that I found most interesting are they're fun. It's kind of fun to create somebody that you can hang around with, that can do something you can't do, that can help you in certain ways. They can be really comforting. So, you know, if you're about to be punished, you can split the punishment with them. If you have too many vegetables on your plate, you can split the vegetables with your imaginary friend. They could be a role model. They could, you know, if you're learning to roller skate or you want to pass legislation and you need somebody to work with, you could, you know, bring on your imaginary friend to help you think about those things. Or, you know, it's helpful to have a civil engineering imaginary friend to help you build a suspension bridge, for instance. They could provide diversity, and this is the part that I find most interesting, is that they can be different than us. We usually have an imaginary friend that has something that's slightly different than us. And that, I think, makes us behave a little differently with our imaginary friends. So, can an imaginary friend be a real person? You're like, what? Those imaginary friends, is imaginary, real, is... Okay. Yeah, so Judy's real. And yet, you can imagine a person. Well, in essence, yes, we all have, I mean, when we learn about things, anybody historical that you've never met, what are you doing to think about them? If you say, I'm thinking of Abraham Lincoln. What do you know about Abraham Lincoln?
Got shot.
How did he dress? Dark clothes, top hat. So we know things about historical figures that we only can think of in our imagination. So historical figures could be imaginary friends. So I was thinking, if you were learning to cook and you wanted somebody very famous to learn to cook with, who might you take on as imaginary friend? Julia Child, exactly. She'd be perfect. She'd teach you how to cook. You'd get your French cooking skills all built up. If you're learning to play basketball, I always thought Larry Bird would be a good person because Larry Bird sounds like an imaginary name. I mean, every time I hear it, I'm like, Larry Bird? So he could be your, you know, your helpful person. Susan B. Anthony, who I read a quote from her this morning, she could be an imaginary friend. If you're working for civil rights within your family, democracy, for the children to have full voting rights. So why are we talking about imaginary friends today? And the reason why is because I think they're important. I think they're very important things to have. They let us step outside of ourselves. So they throw a different light on our lives. And they're a special audience for us that remind us to behave differently. So in the sermon I'm going to read today, Greg Ward, the minister who wrote it, says this: unless we invite the world in, and here I think he was talking about both imagined friends and historical figures, and give them a seat in our spiritual home and ask them to hold us accountable, we run the risk of being a religion that is only interested in ourselves. So in other words, he's asking us to take and incorporate the views of other peoples, these opposites that don't always attract, because sometimes we find ourselves with a lot of people who are the same, and we need somebody who's different to bring into things. And so he's asking us all these things. We could use empathy, and we could also try to feel what others feel, and we could bring our imaginary friends with us to bring that difference into the world, to help share them and make us be better people. So that's all I have this morning, and who's going to be the lantern carrier today? Right? So we'll have some cover music here in a moment. Thank you.
This is the special time in our service where we share our joys and concerns with each other in spiritual community. So if you have a joy or concern that you'd like to share, raise your hand. The ushers will bring you the microphone. And when you get the microphone, tell us your first name and then briefly tell us the joy or concern that you'd like to share. And I'll light a candle to symbolize us, our congregation, holding your joy or concern for you. I'll light our first candle to symbolize the light that we are for each other in creating this brave new world.
Hopefully you can hear me. I have the Christmas crud. But please light a candle of concern for the last remaining member of my mother's generation in the family. Aunt Edith is in the hospital. She's 96. She's lived a wonderful life and has not been ill until now. And her dearest hope is to get back to her assisted living in the family. Thank you.
My name is Eric, and I'd like you to light a candle of concern for my friend Gwen and her family who have just lost their 16-year-old daughter to a lifelong struggle against heart and lung problems. Emily was an incredible little girl and touched a whole lot of lives in her 16 years and will be missed by many, many, many people.
Hi, I'm Barb. I'd like to light a candle of celebration and loss for all of those who passed in this last year. And may we have hope for next year.
Meditation words today come through a couple different people, but mainly through a Dr. Lawrence Britt in an essay he entitled Fascism, Anyone? Political scientist Dr. Lawrence Britt, in his essay titled Fascism, Anyone? studied the social and political agenda common to fascist regimes. His comparisons of Hitler, Mussolini, Franco, Suharto, Pinochet yielded this list of 14 identifying characteristics common to all. So I would like you to listen to these 14 items and think how they relate not only to politics, but also to the religious world, how they relate not just to some previous point in history, but also to us each day as we make decisions to speak out or be silent in the world around us. Number one, constant use of patriotism and nationalism in public gatherings. This includes displays of flags, use of patriotic songs, and applause or deferred respect anytime military is in the room. Two, disdain for the recognition of human rights. The general persuasion by the government that human rights can or should be ignored in certain cases because of need, situations where people are asked to look the other way, understand, or even condone the use of torture, assassination, long incarceration of prisoners, or other methods of violence. Three, identifying enemies or scapegoats to unify a cause. Frequent efforts to label a minority group as a perceived common threat or foe could be based on racial, ethnic, or religious grounds, liberals, communists, socialists, terrorists, etc. Four, supremacy of the military. Even when there are widespread domestic problems, the military is given a disproportionate amount of government funding and the domestic agenda is neglected. Soldiers in military service are glamorized. Five, rampant sexism. The governments of fascist nations tend to be almost exclusively male-dominated. Under fascist regimes, traditional gender roles are more rigid. Opposition to abortion is high, as is homophobia and anti-gay legislation and national policy. Six, attempt by government to control the mass media. Sometimes the media are directly controlled by the government, but in other cases, the media are indirectly controlled by government regulation or sympathetic media spokespeople and executives. Censorship, especially in wartime, is very common. Seven, obsessions with threats to national security. Fear is used as a motivational tool by the government over the masses. Eight, religion and government are intertwined. Governments in fascist nations tend to use the most common religion in the nation as a tool to manipulate public opinion. Religious rhetoric and terminology is common from government leaders, even when the major tenets of the religion, such as charity, care for the oppressed, are diametrically opposed to the government's policies and actions. Nine, corporate power is protected. The industrial and business aristocracy of a fascist nation often are the ones who put the government leaders into power, thus creating a mutually beneficial business-government relationship and power elite. 10. Organized labor is suppressed. Because the organizing power of labor is the only real threat to a fascist government, labor unions are either eliminated entirely or are severely suppressed. 11. Disdain for intellectuals and the arts. Fascist nations tend to discourage or cut funding to higher education and academia and the arts. 12. Obsession with crime and punishment. Under fascist regimes, the people are often asked to overlook police abuses and even forego civil liberties in the name of patriotism. 13. Rampant cronyism and corruption. Fascist regimes almost always are interconnected by friends and associates who appoint each other to government positions and use government power and authority to protect themselves from accountability. And 14, fraudulent elections. Sometimes elections in fascist nations are complete shams. Other times elections are manipulated by smear campaigns against or even assassination of opposition candidates. Use of legislation to control voting numbers or political district boundaries, and manipulation of the media. Fascist nations also typically use their judiciaries to manipulate or control elections. This list should be familiar to students of political science, but it should also be familiar to students of religion as well. for it mirrors the social and political agenda of religious fundamentalisms worldwide. It is both accurate and helpful for us to understand fundamentalism as religious fascism and fascism as political fundamentalism. It is that brutal default setting that civilization has tried to rise above. But civilization always has been a fragile thing and has to be achieved over and over again. We'll take a moment of silence. Please remain seated for our centering hymn number 318. This sermon today comes to us, as last week's, from the Church of the Larger Fellowship. It is titled, UUism for Fun and Profit, and profit is spelled P-R-O-P-H-E-T, and it was written by Reverend Greg Ward and first presented back in November 2005. Greg was the minister at that time of the Unitarian Universalist Metro Atlanta North, which, for those of you who love pronounceable acronyms, unlike LCUUC, this one is UUMAN, which they pronounce human, and rhymes with human. Greg writes the following. On my refrigerator at home, I have a magnet that has a picture of Jesus and the words, "Stop using Jesus as an excuse to be a narrow-minded, bigoted schmuck." On my bulletin board, in my office, I have a picture of Jesus at the Last Supper, a Renaissance depiction where he appears with the disciples, and alongside the disciples, who are in distress, arguing across the table at each other, Jesus looks beatific, beaming at them, with the caption above that shows him as saying, "You're all fired." At home, close to my altar, I have religious action figures, Jesus, Noah, Moses, and for good measure, Mr. T and Spider-Man. I enjoy knowing that people have actually joined my church because they heard of us on both Prairie Home Companion and The Simpsons. I like pulling into the parking lot and seeing bumper stickers like, "God wants spiritual fruits, not religious nuts." I mention these things to make the point that being Unitarian Universalist is fun. That's important to me. And I think a number of people agree. I think a lot of people come to our faith because they believe that being religious does not have to mean constant suffering. Many of us came here because we were a religious alternative to those who see people as sinners in the hands of an angry God. We came because we see ourselves having been born into original blessing, like the Unitarians, and wanting a religion that offers not hell, but hope, like the Universalists. And because ultimately, we believe in a religion where laughter is honored as a sacrament and was not crucified, so that guilt could rise on the third day to remind us that we're sinning if we somehow do something that makes us glad to be in church. Unitarian Universalism can be fun, but for profit? When I titled the sermon, UUism for Fun and Profit, I obviously didn't mean to imply that we were part of a pyramid scheme, or that anyone would get rich here. Most of us have figured out that being UU can be expensive. Although we have fun, we have to pay for everything we do here, with the hope, of course, that what we do is ultimately more rewarding than costly. But how can Unitarian Universalism be for profit? After all, it says quite clearly in our association's bylaws that we are a nonprofit organization, and 501c3 laws require that whatever profits we do reference be unaffiliated with any political party. But does that mean we can't be a prophetic religion? More seriously, does that mean that we should refrain from expressing some religious imperative, specifically some moral or ethical call to action within the political arena? What do you think? This is an issue on which Unitarian Universalists are not of one mind. And although it sometimes is fun to belong to a religion that is out of its one mind, it is something we ought to be clear about. I would like us to think about the appropriateness of political thought and commentary within our worship, or even within our religious lives. But before we do this, I think it is important to invite some accountability into our discussion. Accountability for me, for us. I know that it sometimes makes a difference in conversations who is in the room. Even in reflections, when I write my sermons, it sometimes helps clarify my thoughts to know someone I need to remember is watching. So I would like to invite in the room, by virtue of his identification card, a young man by the name of Wolfgang Munzer. And I'm hoping that his presence will help us take a responsible look at the questions on the table. So let's imagine that he is here with us, listening. Now that we're all here, I'd like to pose this morning's question in a different way, in the form of a letter. It reads, "Dear Reverend Ward, a couple of weeks ago, I came to worship service thinking I had come into a church. But when I left, I wasn't so sure. The sermon was completely political. It was critical of government and of the way society is run and some of the laws being made. They questioned the current administration in a way that seemed to assume everyone agreed with them. It felt very divisive, and it bothered me. Are they always that way? I don't come to church to hear political speeches. If that's what I wanted, I would spend my time at City Hall. I come here to find some peace, for a sense of calm that is all too often missing in my life. I come for spirituality. I thought that is what this community was about, to provide a place for these things, not to get into the same divisive conflicts that are everywhere else in our society. I wanted to get away from that. Can we just focus on spirituality and not have politics in the church? Sincerely, seeking spirituality." Well, let me say this. This is not an actual letter. Since I have been in church, I have received this general message, either in email or written or verbal form, at least a dozen times. What I read was simply a virtual reconstruction of bits and pieces of many expressions. In the past, most of the references, although certainly not all, were in regards to comments that other people made while in this pulpit. So it may be relevant to explain something called freedom of the pulpit, which means something other than what most people think it means. Freedom of the pulpit doesn't mean that anyone who preaches has license to say whatever they want. It does not mean that a pulpit is a glorified soapbox to all who stand there on Sundays. It is actually a covenant forged between a congregation and the minister they call to serve. The covenant means that the congregation entrusts the pulpit to the minister's best judgment in addressing the spiritual needs of the community. In other words, the called minister is responsible and accountable for every single sentiment expressed from the pulpit, whether spoken by the called minister or someone else he or she extends the pulpit to. Now, you might be familiar with how it works in some Christian churches when, in the course of a sermon, the spiritual hunger of the community is being given something nourishing, the people say, "Amen." And when the spiritual hunger of the community is being given something poisonous, the people say, "Ouch," or they gag or choke or faint, except in a Pentecostal church where those could be good things. Freedom of the pulpit means that the called minister is responsible for overseeing the menu, whether that minister is cooking or not. Now, I tend to be among the more liberal of our UU ministers when it comes to extending the pulpit to others. I believe that it is important to hear different voices articulating truth with a small t before anyone in the congregation can begin to hear the universal truths with a capital T. I've also seen that being in a position of speaking to an audience we care about and are accountable to encourages anyone who steps in here to his or her best spiritual thinking. But ultimately, to ensure that what's said is palatable and not poisonous, and because the letters, when this is not the case, come to me, I have the responsibility of being fairly careful who says what. So in that role, I hold out a few things to keep in mind to those preparing to preach here. First, I ask them to remember that the aim is to transform people, that a good sermon will, as they say, comfort the afflicted and afflict the comfortable. Secondly, that if you are planning on afflicting the comfortable, it is important to do so with love. And if you don't plan on doing that, you'd better plan on frisking them at the door for weapons. I always say that it is better to fall short on the aim of transforming people, but never fall short of loving them. Finally, I implore them to know that love, spiritual love, always offers a preferential option to the poor. And that is why it is good to, at least in our minds, invite someone who we know needs to be remembered, like Wolfgang Munzer, who will keep us accountable. I offer you this explanation to let you know that I care greatly about everyone who sits in this congregation Sunday after Sunday, and I try to ensure that what the people in these seats hear from the pulpit is love. I know, like the letter states, that people come here hurting, sometimes feeling broken, seeking a sense of wholeness that is missing from their lives. I believe it is my responsibility as a minister and our responsibility as a church to offer that. But I think it is also our responsibility as a religion, especially one that is expressly devoted towards being open and inclusive, to love the world, to understand that the world is also hurting, sometimes feels broken, and seeks a sense of wholeness that is missing. Unless we invite the world in, give them a seat in our spiritual home, ask them to hold us accountable, we run the risk of being a religion that is only interested in ourselves, a religion that is for fun and not for profit. E.B. White once said, "I wake up each morning torn between the choice to save or to savor the world. It makes it very hard to plan the day." If we are just going to savor and not save, just spend our freedom for fun and not for profit, it still costs us. The price we pay is living with knowing we sit by savoring our freedoms while others struggle. And because we are caring people, people who believe we were born as agents of original blessing, not sin, who believe in not hell, but hope, witnessing such struggle in the world around us can leave us feeling disengaged with our better selves, less compassionate, less generous, less powerful than we believe ourselves to be. These feelings can plague us, leave us in despair. They are often the feelings that send us in search of a spiritual community, one not about guilt, but hope, one that offers peace, not one that stirs up divisiveness, but in a place we can turn to for love, to have the afflicted parts of ourselves comforted, not have the last of our comforts afflicted. Religion is ultimately about how to heal the brokenness, both within ourselves and the world. It translates from the Latin to mean to bind together again, to find what is lost, restore what is broken. Politics is the distribution of power and the deployment of resources. It is what decides who are the haves and the have-nots, who gets a hand up and who gets stepped on. There's another bumper sticker found in many UU parking lots which says this: if you want peace, work for justice. It is this that asks us to recognize the power of love and to exercise that power with a preferential option for the poor. It is this that asks us to remember we stand for everyone, not just for people who are like us, and to remember that our heritage calls us to speak truth to power. That's what makes us prophets. It's important to remember that the biblical prophets were not crackpots who preached that we had to believe in God. They preached that we had to believe in our covenant to address real world concerns. The prophets we know, like Elisha, Amos, Hosea, and Isaiah, were not sequestered in the religious world, ranting from a soapbox out in the wilderness. They worked in the political world. They were actually advisors to kings, political spin doctors who tried to keep power accountable to moral imperatives. They spoke of the rights of the poor, the wrongs of military oppression, and reminders that the least among us still have intrinsic worth and deserve our extrinsic attention. Unitarians and Universalists understand that when religion becomes obsessed with itself and imposes its will on its people instead of serving them, it creeps into fundamentalism. And when government becomes obsessed with itself, it creeps into fascism. And when they both do this in concert with one another, such as was the case in Nazi Germany, and there is no prophetic voice willing to speak truth to power, then the people perish, and peace and justice are lost. One of the things that keeps me loyal to Unitarian Universalism, besides its being willing to be for fun, is its willingness to be for profit as well. The Unitarian Service Committee was willing to recognize, even before the United States was willing to get involved, that Nazi Germany was a fascist regime, oppressing and killing people while religion and the rest of the world stood idly by. When I went to the Holocaust Museum in Washington, D.C., I was introduced to Wolfgang Munzer. When you enter, they hand you an identification card. I got his. As you go through the first floor and see the horrific conditions that led up to Nazism, the conditions the world tried so hard to ignore, you are asked to read a little bit about the person who is walking you through the horror. How he grew up, how he had dreams to study but was kept out of school for being a Jew. The second floor shows the buildup of fascism and the oppression of minorities. I read how Wolfgang tried to escape, but he was caught and sent with his parents to Auschwitz. On the third floor, they show you the gas chambers and the inhumanity people suffered. And you read the last page to see if your guy lives or dies. Wolfgang Munzer lived. He survived 4 years at Auschwitz, but his parents were gassed on arrival. I keep his ID card on my desk when I write my sermons. I keep a seat in the congregation for him. He holds us accountable for the need to speak truth to power and to goad me when I get so comfortable I become complacent. On the cover of the ID card, it reads, "For the dead and the living, we must bear witness." I remember in the museum, there was a large sign that read, remember all those who were involved in the Holocaust, the perpetrators, the victims, the bystanders, the rescuers, and the liberators. The victims wanted the world to know. The perpetrators wanted the world not to know. The bystanders wanted the world not to know that they knew. Part of religion's job of healing a broken world is to help us know ourselves. Part of it is to help us know others, and part of it is never to let ourselves forget what we know. It is great that we are able to have fun as Unitarian Universalists, but it is important to remember that the fun we have can only come when we are free. Others may not have fun because they do not have the freedom to make that choice. Peace, what we seek and what the world seeks, can only come when all are free. Justice will only come about when we, who are free, speak truth to power and save a place within our freedom for those still struggling to find the glory of life. We have a few moments for polylogue if anybody has comments or replies. I always find it interesting when I read somebody else's sermon, as you imagine yourself as that person. I'm not a minister. I'm just presenting it. I have not been to the Holocaust Museum. But I really like the idea of having somebody that you invite with you as you think about what you're presenting to other people. So if there's any comments or other viewpoints, other statements, feel free to raise your hand and an usher will bring you a microphone in a couple moments. Then we'll move on with our service.
So now we'll collect the offertory to support our spiritual community. If you're visiting today, please know that an offering is not expected. We will receive, in grateful appreciation, any offertory today for our shared hopes and dreams. Thank you, Morgan. Please join me in the congregational affirmation number 658, to risk. To laugh is to risk appearing the fool.
To weep is to risk appearing sentimental.
To reach out for another is to risk exposing our true self.
To place our ideas, our dreams before the crowd is to risk loss.
To love is to risk not being loved in return.
To hope is to risk despair.
To try is to risk failure.
To live is to risk dying.
And please stand as you're willing and able to sing our closing hymn, which is number 40, The Morning Hangs a Signal.
Closing words come from Kelly Weissman Asforth Jackson. She writes, "Rooted in the paths worn deeply before us, marking the routes which fall to us to navigate ourselves, I send you out into the world with this hope. May the peace that is passive and limited and only for some be replaced by the peace that is active and limitless and touches all souls. May the anger that hardens hearts and turns hands into fists be replaced by the anger that demands change and calls out for justice. May the comfort enjoyed by the few at the expense of the many be replaced by the comfort that yearns to be shared with all. May the pain that dulls us to the cares and concerns of others be replaced by the pain that gives us insight into the needs of our neighbors. Go forth from this place and set the world on fire with your lives. And you're welcome to talk and mill about and head towards the social hall during the post-blue.